Blog Talk Radio.
Alafia, greetings and hotep. Welcome to the Care to Read Room. You've got your Omenika live coming to you straight from my studio. I'd like to welcome each and every one of you to a new month and also to Women's History Month. I'd like to thank you for joining us this evening. And we also like to say Habari Ghani because we're still in the spirit of acknowledging those of us who still perpetuate and practice African-American history rituals. I'd like to thank you for joining us and being here and being president accounted for. However, we do have our chat rooms open. If you'd like to join us in the chat room, you're welcome to do so. And we'd like to also ask you to lock that dial in at 646-478-0270. Lock it in, little G, and keep it right there. Our topic for this month will still be working on where women are rising, where are they advancing themselves. And as you know, we were talking about students in law school, specifically women. And last night we talked about a very, very unique situation about women in duality doing entrepreneurial business with a spouse. We featured a husband and wife team who actually talk about their corporation that they are developing in Africa and as well as stateside. And if you go out to our website, you can see some of the products that they actually have created from our excess plastic. They've actually taken the plastic and broken it down into a chemical where it can be used as a fabric. And if you go out and take a look at some of the purses that they're producing, they're creating jobs and opportunities abroad. And they'll soon be working with some of the women here in the United States to utilize them as being marketers. So we are rising. Women are rising all over the nation. And they are doing their own thing and working abroad and stateside. So we like to encourage you to encourage all of our students who are in school. As you know, Project 2019 supports women that are working in biomedicine as well as in pre-college programs in engineering. And we'd like to feature those law students, and we've talked to them about partnering with them so that we can assist them in having airtime. Now, last year we offered all of our legal lawyers and paralegals free airtime. We are also going to be doing that in the future for our paralegals as well as for our law students who are exiting out of law school. We're going to be doing something special where they'll have free airtime. Now, we're also going to have to create a reunion to bring all those law students and those lawyers, those new lawyers back because there were quite a few last year in family law. So this year, we're talking with some Loyola University. And we're talking to them about unique situations where some of them have cut through bureaucracy in male-dominated fields. We're also talking to them about what were the crucial things about enrolling in law school, such as completing the LSAT, and also looking at the actual finalization of can you afford the tuition. We've been talking to them about ways that they're able to finance their tuition. As you know, some of the legal aid offices will assist in aid scholarships, and there's fundings out there for those candidates who go and work in lower socioeconomic areas. We've been heavily talking about that, primarily because this show is ran for not just the masses of the people, but for those people who live in lower socioeconomic areas who can't afford law. We want them to know that we're not talking about services that are beyond them, but services that they can access. And that is our reason for opening up these airways for those law students, so that they'll realize that they have a commitment to go back into their community, because our degrees belong to our community who faithfully support us. So we must go back and service them with our low-income service such as pro bono. Now, tonight we'll be featuring another one of our returning law students, and I'd like to go out and say hello to her. So if you just wait with me as I go out. And I'd like to say hello to those people in the chat room, guest 2088-2, how are you? Thank you for joining us. Do come in and have a seat, and if you'd like to facilitate, you're welcome to do so. Now let me go out and welcome our guest, and we're going to give our guest a drum roll. Hello, caller number 313, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Okay, am I speaking to Christina?
Yes, this is Christina.
Hi, Christina, how are you this evening? I'm glad you can join us. And we are live and well and ready to take off the show, but if you allow us to, we want to do a little house cleaning, and we'll meet you in the atmosphere, so we're going to give you a drum roll. Hold tight, Christina.
Okay.
Welcome, Christina, to our chat room, to our peer review room. We'd like to thank her so very much for coming back and joining us. Omiika here. I am your advocate here to serve you. I am also your advisor. You haven't talked to your advisor in a while. I am your advisor here to serve you, and I am your Maliwa. And I'd like to thank each and every one of you. And as we go over to the Care to Read room, I'd like for you to stand at attention as if you're in a position to receive with your hands up. And we do this ritual in honor of our deceased loved ones and our ancestors who we hold in high regards, because it's their shoulders that we stand on. And we know without them, we could not be here today, standing in this room talking unmolested. They're the sum total of why we're here. So we'd like to acknowledge our ancestors, Christina. And if you'd like to go over with us and give out any of your heroes or sheroes or your deceased loved ones who you'd like to remember as we call out their names, we reconnect them back to the greater circle. And as I go over, I like to pour libation, first of all, to Oladulama Ray, who is the higher force in our life, and we love to say Ashe to Oladulama Ray. Ashe. I like to pour libation to my mother spirit, and I like to say Ashe, Clara Jenkins, Ashe, in her name representing Yamin Ye. Ashe. I like to pour libation to my father's spirit, Robert Jenkins, in representing Obatala, the man in white, and we say Ashe. I pour libations to the east, and I say Ashe. I pour libations to the west, and I say, Harriet Tubman, come and join us and sit with us, Ashe. I pour libations to the north, and I say, Ashe. And I say, Sojourner the Truth, bring your truth firm so you can once again submit the truth firm so that we all may be reconnected, Ashe. I pour libations to the west, and I say, Ashe. I pour libations to Thurgood Marshall, and I say, Ashe. I pour libations to Nina Simone, and I call Nina Simone as she comes back and resurrects the music that she so politely wrote on account of the Jim Crow laws. I say, Nina, we will be erecting your music, and I say, Ashe. I call on the name of, I call on the great name of Dr. Martin Luther King and his sweet wife, sweet Coretta King, and I say, Ashe. I also call Dr. Carruthers, and I say, reconnect the circle back. And I call on the name of John Henry Clark, one of our heroes, and I say, Ashe. And I call on the name of Joe Lewis. May he come and knock out injustice and knock out racism in our time to come. And I say, Ashe. Now, if you'd like to name any names of your loved ones or your heroes, Christina, you may do so.
I say Ashe to my grandmother, who is now deceased, and also my great-grandmother, who is now deceased.
Ashe, Ashe. And Ashe means, so be it, so let it be done. And we thank you so very much, ladies and gentlemen. And as we say a prayer for the family during this month of March, we are celebrating women all over the nation, and they're rising throughout the communities, not only here in the United States, but abroad as well. And because we know that there are some women who are still molested, unable to go to school, who are forbidden to even select their spouse and who their husbands will be, we say that we pray a prayer that they may be released today, that they might be able to make their own decision, the ability to name for themselves and to decide for themselves. And we just thank God that he has given us an opportunity to speak out on injustice for women. Now, we'd like to also talk about the fact that we know that in the political arena, there's a lot going on. And today we'd like to talk about the political arena. And this is something that is so near and close to me right now. There is something that's getting ready to occur in Chicago with the national political movement in Chicago on account of Gary, Indiana's national political date that they had when Mayor Hatchett was in office, and they took large groups of people downstate to rally around the political convention for Black political convention. And that is coming up in July, and there will be much, much collaboration going on with bringing political people together to once again to go to Washington, D.C. to collaborate in the efforts to bring political parties together and to bring up issues that address African Americans. Now, we do know that there are many women in the political arena, and we also know that there are lawyers that are out there in the forefront doing litigation. And we're hoping and praying that the students who come out of school are able to transition into political movements and be a part of some of those advocacies. And we're going to talk a little bit about advocacy work and political movement and how a female could be a part of those legacies, because some of our past brothers and sisters left a legacy for us, and we have some real large footprints to carry out in. And as we look back over Fannie Lou Hamer with all the work that she did and the changes she made for the world, there are great footprints that we have to follow out. But it seems like to me there are very few heroes out there, and not very many people want to carry the torch. But we have to create a desire for young women and men to want to carry that torch. So I'm going to ask you, Christina, if you were to carry a torch of justice and you were going to ring out throughout the nation, which torch would you want to carry and which particular issue would you want to address that would make a difference in our society today?
One thing that I feel makes a tremendous difference in our community is education, and it's just having equal access for all to education, and it starts within the public school system. And being a part of the Detroit Public Schools, I know what it's like to be in an underfunded community where you have a lot of students who have a drive and want to learn, but there aren't always enough resources there for you to get an adequate education. And then it makes it a lot more difficult for you to compete against students who do have the resources in their school district to be able to get higher scores on the ACT and the SAT, which then makes it a little more difficult to get the funding that is necessary to go into higher education and to be able to afford to go to college, which then makes it even more difficult to be able to compete and go to graduate school and become professionals. So I feel one of the things that I would advocate for the most in the political arena would be just education in general, starting with public schools for younger students, for kids. And that way, once education is strong in school districts, that empowers more people to be able to go to college, which empowers more people to be able to go to professional schools and graduate schools, which then allow more professionals to come out with the knowledge that they need that will help society as a whole.
And, you know, Christina, that is exactly what is needed in our society, more pre-college programs. We know that there were, back in the 60s, there was a real big push to create all sorts of pre-college programs, and the universities were putting programs in place all over. And as we look now, a lot of funding has dried up, so they've actually pulled those programs back, and they're not able to offer them. But in some of your bigger or top 10 universities, and such as Loyola University, I'm so pleased that they're able to continue with their law academy, pushing it throughout the city of Chicago to get those students out there that are minorities, because those are the students who were not likely to go to college. Back in the 90s, I participated in Parkside University's pre-college program for 5 years, and students that I was able to recommend were able to go to this pre-college program, and the majority of those kids in the program were geared towards college. And when we actually graduated them out of the program, they were geared up and ready to go to college. I think what those programs do is show the students that they're capable of doing well in the college setting. And that's primarily what we're doing, is giving them a prelude or a tester of what the atmosphere is like in going to college. How is it to have a professor, and they had actual live professors that they were working with. So I think the pre-college program that Loyola has in the Law Academy is definitely on the right path of recruiting African-American minorities, because a lot of those children would not ordinarily go to college if there weren't for those pre-college programs. Now, let's talk a little bit about that Law Academy. And I know you said you were just getting involved in it. I was looking over the curriculum for street law, and in the actual text itself, I noticed that there are no schools here, to my knowledge, in Indiana who are actually offering that program. They offer segments of street law within social studies, which is what I taught when I taught social studies. However, I'd like to, set the precedence where there would be more of a desire to implement the actual Law Academy right along with the pre-college programs in biomedicine and engineering. That's the biggest thing here in Indiana, is pre-college programs for engineering and biomedicine. And I'm going to soon be recommending that they add the street law, because so many children would do so much better on those first charges if they only knew about what their rights were and what is illegal, because you have lots of children guessing their way through law, and most of those young people are ignorant of the law. So what would you suggest that could be done in the elementary schools that would help push and further the cause of law by introducing a curriculum at the elementary level? What would you suggest that we recommend or introduce to some of our school districts?
Well, just introduce it as a new part of the curriculum to add on to world history or government or any of the other types of classes that are already offered. Just add, you want to start small. You don't want to overwhelm the school districts, especially ones in Gary, Indiana, that are kind of strained financially. So maybe just adding a week, a part of the actual curriculum that's already set in place, just so that they can learn more of the aspects of law that has been added since then. I know that growing up in school, I didn't know much about the law. You really don't start to learn a lot about the law until you get to middle school and probably in high school, and that's when you start to learn about your constitutional rights. And even then, it still seems as if when I got into law school, it just seems as if a lot of the stuff about the Constitution and my rights as an individual, you really didn't know of, like, because they didn't really touch on it as much. They kind of braced over it, told you what the Constitution was, but they really didn't implement how it works. So just kind of enhancing the curriculum that we already have and then working from there, because you don't want to just start a brand new program and not have adequate funding for it. But if you start off small and work big and also see the impact that it has, it'll be easier to gain funding for a program like a street law class and on the elementary law school level.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about Indiana's requirement for their core and their standards, they use the same outline for elementary that they use for middle school and high school. They learn the same stems and the same adequate amount of material for all grade levels. It is only enhanced as they go further up in to the higher educational level, such as your kindergarten will be learning the same thing that your middle schoolers and high schoolers are learning. And I taught history in the Gary Community Schools. That part of it I really enjoyed, because whatever I was echoing in the elementary school, they were echoing it in the middle school and high school, which is consistent. The main thing I thought was, in order to make it more applicable and interesting to those older children, it has to be acted out. So one of the things we did was we created a micro school, which would be a microcosm of what the universe is like and what the real world is like. We took that and created a classroom that actually had a jurisdictional system, and it was a solvent community where they did their governing of their laws, and they had their banking system. So we treated it as if it was like a micro city, so that whatever that was in the larger, whatsoever is above is below. And these children were very, very intrigued about coming to school, because they were paid money as if they were coming to a job. And they also had their own store, which they could purchase from, their banks. And then when there was some type of offense or criminal offense, that they literally got citations and got tickets and actually were due to go to court. And there was a court system that we actually took them through, and they had to go in and, you know, the jury, the whole bit. So the children tend to really, really enjoy that, but we had to do all of our academics rather quickly by noontime, and then we opened up the micro school in the afternoon. There were more children that was interested in this, and I did this with kindergartners, and they became so fluent in understanding how that social studies curriculum worked. It was a real-life inactivation of what the real world was like. And they understood about dollars and cents, because they realized that these dollars and cents had their picture on it, and it meant something, because when they came to school, they expected to be paid because it was a job. And they all had tasks And when they got to class, they put their aprons on, and they could go to the board, and they could actually log on to which category they were working on. It's sort of like the mission to Mars. And I saw this done with the mission to Mars, where every student trains for a profession. There should be no more classroom where you sit passively listening to the instructor. You come in and you train for a certain task, and you rotate those tasks until you've learned all tasks. So you get these students ready to go out into the workforce, and they're no longer passively leaving the school system without pedagogical philosophy. I knew that the children had to be introduced to the understanding. They had to have a hypothesis. They had to collect data. So all of these things that they would have to do throughout life, you start them early on so they understand that if you had a hypothesis, you must go out and find the data to support your statement. So all these things, the scientific method was introduced early on, because African children, I found that when I started doing my research, African children are so much advanced than the Westerners. Those children start out even at the preschool level, they are developing faster, and even their language level is more enhanced. You can teach them 3 or 4 languages at the same time. So I think that we're dumbing down our curriculum, and we are stagnating our children, and that's part of why there needs to be an overhaul of the curriculum, and someone needs to relook at, are we taking children that are very intelligent and dumbing down the curriculum? What do you think?
I absolutely agree. I feel like students are a lot smarter than they ever were at this point in time, at a young, very, very young age. You have 2- and 3-year-olds able to work a smartphone or iPad and technology, as to when I was growing up, we didn't really know what computers were. So it's just like we need to utilize that time to really feed into the our youth how important education is and what they should learn, because at that age there's so much that they can absorb. They absorb the most in their brains at that point in their lives. So by utilizing it, what better way to teach our youth how to be proper people in society than by helping them learn exactly how society works. So you need schools and you need school systems to step up and say, okay, this isn't working right now with the lecturing and everything, because law school isn't like that, and a lot of graduate professions aren't like that anymore, where they just sit there and lecture you the entire time, and then you absorb it, take notes, and then regurgitate that out at the end of the semester. Now they're incorporating it through clinics, and they're allowing you to have one-on-one skills experience within your field. What better way for you to learn how to be a lawyer than to sit down and actually become a lawyer and know what is taught to you one-on-one that you will see when you are actually in the field of law? So if you start to use that and utilize the techniques that they use in graduate school systems, down in elementary school, in middle school, high school, and even in undergrad, by throwing them into the things that you want them to learn, it will become second nature to them. You wouldn't have them struggling to understand things because they are right there in it, they're immersed in it, and they know how to naturally respond to it. So yeah, I feel like you're right on with that.
Where is your viewpoints on this? It seems like you're very, very endowed about children, which is really good. What is your viewpoint on boys learning differently from girls? In my few years of being in the profession, I found that boys learn completely different than girls, and I've had to administer curriculum differently to girls than I did to boys, and primarily because the boys were rather rambunctious, but they were very, very good in retaining information, but they were kinesthetically involved, and they had to involve their whole self in order to learn. So I realized that when I did my graduate research, I wrote a book, and I'm working on producing and publishing that book now after almost 10 years of research, and observing African-American children, I discovered that they were learning and bypassing the brain, most African-American children. They did not necessarily had to have the lesson first and then get the understanding. They could actually go near the display, the materials, kick it up, examine it, turn it over, flip it over, touch it, go back and tell you everything about it. And to my surprise, I kept saying, well, how is this possible when they haven't even had the lecture on it? And this kept repeating itself throughout the course of my teaching, my 35 years of being in education. Then it dawned on me, if melanin has the capability of functioning like a brain, then you would not need to direct this information right to the brain. The skin is a part of melanin, and it functions just like a brain, so that would mean that knowledge would bypass, you could bypass the brain, and they can learn right from their skin because their skin would act as if it was a brain, processing everything like the occipital and the global and temporal, the whole bit. So I went and researched Dr. Carroll's research on melanin, and I was able to concur with Dr. Carroll. He, too, said that there was no need to take African-American children through the brain process part where the front lobe picks up and has memory, but the African-American child learns so differently that they only need to be exposed to an enriched curriculum. And this was proven through a group of professors dropping off a box of iPads in Africa, jarred open, of course, so that they could get in a little bit, not completely. These African children opened the box, went through it. Never have they ever held any type of technical equipment such as a laptop, computer, desktop, or iPad. But they managed to get into the iPad box, open it up, and started to program the iPad. And not only did they get into the iPad, but they managed also to get into the language aspect of the machine, and they began to teach themselves alphabets through going through this iPad, and they literally found a way to manipulate this iPad. And when the professors came back, they were literally singing the songs off of the program that was put on the iPad, and they were amazed at how they got in it. So that stands the reason with my research also that you only need to create an enriched environment. There's very little that the teacher needs to do because technically the children already are geared and they are actually charged for learning. You only need to induce what's already there by creating an environment that will help induce the knowledge. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes. Well, I feel that it's not just a boy-girl thing or African-American, Caucasian thing. I feel like each person learns differently. And I know that in my scholarship program when I was an undergraduate, they took the time to really see and gave us the Myers-Briggs test and gave us other types of self-assessment exams just to see how do we learn. And by that, we were able to get more insight on better ways for us to absorb information and be able to use it to study for exams. And I've also noticed that law schools now have been working with tutors and different programs as well.
Well, Christine, wouldn't you also say you yourself said the other day that there was a bell curve. And we know how racist the bell curve is because there was a lot of data out about the bell curve. It is definitely racist. It is not conducive to African Americans because truly it becomes biased because of the language. It makes it biased. So it is an issue of boy girl because they've already had enough documentation to substantiate that the Westerners were far behind the African children because they were completely potty trained by 8 months old. They were able to speak languages, to cool, to have expressions. This is all in my research, and I spent 10 years researching it, and I wouldn't be saying it if I hadn't researched it. I was shocked myself because what we've actually have done it's taken the attitude that African Americans would have to be remediated when, in fact, they are grown by the age of 12 years old. So if you got grown children at 12 years old and you got them in the classroom, he starts to act out or she starts to act out, it's because they are truly probably upset up to their neck because they are grown people who are frustrated when you need to get on with the subject of the matter and you're carrying in through all this infinite childlike information. And I've discovered it in my 35 years. You must teach African Americans differently, and you must understand that they still have the intestines of African children, so they're still African-driven. So if we continue to say we want the British, we want the European, then that's what we're getting. And look at our schools. They're falling apart. They are falling apart.
Well, one thing is, like, I wasn't saying that there aren't differences between the races and there aren't differences between the genders, but when you also isolate those two categories or even more different categories that there are, each individual learns within that category differently. Like, because
what do you think of the bell curve? Did you think that was fair when you had to go through the bell curve? Didn't you read all the history behind the bell curve?
Well, I never really had to read the history about it because it's like we really don't have a choice. Every law school in the nation operates on a bell curve because that is, I guess that's how law school differentiates students. But even with the history of the bell curve, you work your hardest. You try to do what you can. You try to learn as much as you can. But I do not feel that the bell curve is fair. And it's not just for African-American students, but any student. Because you're put against the odds of what the curve is set. So even if you get 100% on the exam, if someone else gets 101 or even a different sentence or another type of phrase differently than you, then they can get that A and you don't because you didn't get exactly what that other student got. I personally don't feel that's fair.
Christina, I just got out of postgraduate school, and being in postgraduate school, it's very, very, like you said, they have changed the whole didactics where now they want you to interact and they want you to be a part of the team because this is how society is. However, I think there's some biases that come in when they create an atmosphere where they throw you in a group with someone and you're in that group and the support team that you're supposed to be creating, people coming from other states, it becomes an illusion because you're trying to create an atmosphere where people don't want outside people in their group. So they tend to have a tendency to want to leave that person on the outside, and the professors don't know how to interact and say, look, everyone will have a place here, so let me go through and we'll count out by twos and we'll place it that way. But when people start to select, just like you and I, when we start picking our teams, we pick those that look like us and we pick our best friends. And some people don't get picked. And it might consistently be the same group of people. So grad school needs to change in that respect. That's very childish when they start allowing the students to function as if they are the teachers and they are the vanguards, and they are helping to make a decision on your grade. I don't like that because they should not have that kind of control because you pay the professor to manage you and to tutelage you, not the other student. And I see a lot of that in the colleges, and I had to speak out about it because we did a whole segment where we talked about racism within the school system, and the Hispanic, they have a piece right now where online, if their names are typed a certain way, the professor knows they're Hispanic, they get less attention, less tutelage, and they find themselves dropping out of the program. So a lot of that has got to be addressed, and until we can address it and be honest about it, what happens, it continues to go on. And that's why a lot of graduate students have to write about it, and they have to be outspoken about it, because this is how you change things. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, and I also feel that a lot of things are starting to change. Like, they are starting to see, because some professions, including the law profession, when they go out to become attorneys, it's not always the top 10% of the class that are the first ones to get the great job. They're not always the best attorneys out there. So it's like they're starting to look at the person more as a whole than they have in the entire history of law. They're starting to, some schools are instituting, taking out, not letting people know their rank, the rank of the class until after they've graduated, to help companies to see past that person's rank into who that person really is. And because of our profession being so competitively driven by whatever your grades were that first year of law school, a lot of schools are responding like this. They are starting to see that this isn't a fair assessment of who that person is. Just because they got a 4.0 their first semester of law school and another student got a 2.8, that doesn't really mean that they're going to be a better lawyer than the other student. So now there are schools that are stepping out and saying, okay, let's not rank our students. Or some of them have pass-fail classes, like Harvard. They have pass-fail classes without necessarily having letter grades, so that if you pass a class, you have the equal opportunity as any other student to have a shot at those jobs, instead of separating students by, okay, you're in the top 10% of your class, you get this X amount of jobs, and then anyone else below that, now these are the jobs that you have to compete with. So I do agree that there needs to be a change over the stretch, but I'm starting to see that society is also seeing that there needs to be a change. You're starting to see a movement in graduate schools to start a change, but also undergraduates need to start a change as well. If you have minority students in the class, you have to cater to the needs of all your students instead of just trying to loop all of them into one category. So I'm starting to see a difference, but like you said, there is a change, much more needed change that is occurring.
Well, thank you so very much. And I'd like to say to the audience, thank you so much for joining us in the chat room. And thank Christina for coming back to join us on part two. And Christina, we wish you all the well in your grad school and your effort to complete your law degree. And we'd like to invite you back again for our reunion. We're going to be bringing lawyers back, as well as those who graduate can come back and they can feature in this room at any time to talk about their law practice and give them some free air time. And we're all winners, and we're going to advance ourselves to the point where we're going to help each other and pull each other up by the bootstrap. And we'd like to thank all of those other law students who have come in to support us. And we are winners, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you so much. And do join us on the 2nd. We will be talking with a record label lady who has just gone into business for herself, and she will be talking about the music industry. So if you'd like to join us, please join us on the 2nd, and we will see you then. Thank you so much, and take care, and have
you're
a great
ready?
Evening. Thanks, Christina.
Like you'll need a